This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. Time now for the Outdoorsman Radio Show with your host, Alan Ellis.
Hey, we're with Harry Hornick here today, ladies and gentlemen, the fisheries ecologist from Maryland's Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Service. And Harry's been with the department for quite a while, almost 30 years, and has dealt with blue crabs. And his specialty right now, you're specializing in striped bass.
Yes, I spent most of my time with striped bass. Started out, as you mentioned.
You don't have any other friends? Or
what's that?
I say you don't have any other friends?
I've got a few friends. Yeah, you're one of them.
Well, I appreciate that. But you do a lot of work with striped bass. You're the point guy, basically.
One of the people. I mean, there's a lot of important people working on striped bass behind the scenes, you know, with the department.
Sure.
So I really, like I said, I can't take any credit because there's a lot of good people, you know, throughout the state working with
striped bass. Let me tell you what, your biologist and the boots on the ground folks, I've said this over and over again, and I'll continue to say it, you're some of the finest in the nation, and you guys are extremely dedicated with limited resources, and we think that you guys do a tremendous job. So, especially on a fish as important as a striped bass and our importance here to the fishery in Maryland and Chesapeake Bay, the peak spawning grounds of the striped bass. They come from up and down the coast to spawn here, and we've been hosting them for a long, long time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and Maryland, serves as anywhere between 75% and 90% of the, East Coast population of fish, originates from Chesapeake Bay.
Really?
Spawns in the Chesapeake Bay area. Yeah.
Give the folks a little bit of a biology lesson on where the striped bass come from to spawn here.
Striped bass in Maryland, Chesapeake Bay, I mean, they can be spawning in any of the rivers in Maryland, Virginia. They're coming from, basically there's like two components of the striped bass stock. There's what we call the migratory component,
right,
which is what's coming into the bay now. It's basically the older fish.
Right.
They come in the bay, in early spring, kind of stage, they get ready for the right conditions,
mm-hmm.
water temperatures, daylight, all those, environmental cues that,
right.
Once water temperature gets around, 50 degrees, that's, 50. They can spawn in temperatures, starting at like 52 degrees, but in Chesapeake Bay, it's around, 57 to 66. That's like the prime water temperature.
Okay.
We're not there yet. But, once the stripers spawn, they head out of the bay. They're encountered by our trophy season fishery.
Right.
Once they leave the bay, they head basically north up the Atlantic coast.
Okay.
Where over the summertime they'll be off the New England area,
right?
Massachusetts, that area where they're fished on by folks up there,
right?
As the fall proceeds, they kind of start grouping up and they head south and kind of migrate, down the East Coast, the Atlantic Coast, where they basically will overwinter, like off of North Carolina, south of the mouth of the bay.
Okay.
And kind of staged there for next spring, where then they will, sometimes they'll come into the bay in December on their way down the coast, but usually they pretty much follow that same pattern where,
yep.
they're very, very highly migratory.
Sure.
Now, the other component of the striped bass stock, the pre-migratory part, they're the fish that, they are born in the bay, they're born, they hatch, they basically spend, their first few years in the bay. They're very migratory. They move around a lot in the bay itself.
Right.
And what happens is, like with female striped bass, once they start reaching 3, 4, sometimes a little bit younger, they become migratory. They leave the bay. Like when springtime comes around and those older fish leave, they leave with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that everybody leaves at once. There's like a certain percentage that leave every year, so that by the time they're 8 to 10 years old, like the majority of fish of a year class,
right,
male and female, they have become migratory. They're out on the bay. However, there's always some outliers, and we've had in our winter surveys, our fall and winter surveys, we've had fish, 10, 12, 13 years old that have stayed in the bay. They may be the last fish that's that old in the bay, but they still stay in the bay for some time. So it's not any kind of you know, it's almost like the more we know about them, the more we find out, oh, you know, we didn't know they did that.
So they do that. Sure. So once they're spawned, they spend the first couple of years here in the Chesapeake Bay.
Yes, sir.
But do we actually have a resident population of Chesapeake Bay striped bass, or do we actually have striped bass that are that haven't started their migratory part of their life?
That basically they haven't migrated yet. They haven't left the bay.
So when we say we have a resident, when people say they have a resident population of striped bass, we do have fish in the bay, but it's constantly changing as those fish get older and start that migratory process. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, definitely.
So
you know, again, we call it the resident / pre-migratory component of the stock. You know, it's fish that just, you know, they overwinter in the bay. They stay here, and then once they become migratory, you know, I believe that they stay migratory. They don't, for some reason, decide, oh, I think I'll stay here this winter. It's milder.
Yeah. Okay.
Here. I think, you know, once they join the other side of the fence, you know, they then travel with
okay.
the population.
All right. Well, that makes a lot of sense because you know, people were talking about migratory fish and non-migratory fish, and basically what you're saying is that the quote resident striped bass don't actually stay here their entire life cycle.
Correct. Yeah, the fisheries that we have, you know, basically are you know, the recreational fishery in you know, from June on, you know, through December for the recreational people, those are fish that, you know, they stay in the bay. They're the resident population.
Right.
You know, the commercial fishery that's open during the wintertime, those are fish that, you know, are here. They stay here. You know, they're here year round.
Sure.
And then again, when, you know, once the trophy season comes around, they're, you know, it's managed so that they're giving, you know, Maryland anglers a chance to get some of these large fish that really only are here for a short period of time. And they spend, you know, 10 months of the year or 11 or 9 months of the year, you know, out on the coast, you know, being you know, harvested by everybody else up
right.
on the East Coast.
So. Right. Okay. So here we are just prior to the striped bass season, and, you know, we're looking at everybody wants to know, when are they spawning? Did they spawn? Have they spawned? Are they going to spawn? You know, and it's actually a thing that takes place over a couple of weeks, basically. Isn't that right?
Yes, and actually, I mean, striped bass, the striped bass spawning period
yeah.
in Chesapeake Bay, you know, pretty much goes from May through, you know, I'm sorry, April and May.
Right.
April being like the peak spawning month.
Right.
And every year it's maybe a little different. Last year it was a little bit earlier.
Because of the temperature of the water.
The very, you know, mild winter that we had.
Right.
You know, they spawned very early, and a lot of the fish, I mean, they were out of town when the spring trophy season was open.
Yeah,
so,
they were already done and gone. In other words,
yeah, harvest was down. I mean, people thought, you know, there was something wrong.
Right.
And I mean, on our research surveys, you know, we documented, you know, very high, well, relatively high abundance on the spawning grounds.
Because, right.
You know, we have biologists that are out there sampling right now as we speak, and you know, they've saw, you know, in the upper bay they had, you know, one of the highest numbers of females, a percent of females last year. But again, because of the earlier peak spawns, those fish, you know, those fish were not available to the recreational fishermen, you know, simply because of biology.
Sure. Now, you said you had a high percentage of females on the spawning grounds of spawning reaches last year.
Yes. I mean, when we do these surveys, I mean, we're using experimental gear that encounters all sizes of fish that could be on the spawning grounds.
Right.
And you know, we're looking at, you know, we're taking lengths on everything. We're taking scales on most everything.
Sure.
With females, we take scales on every female.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, last year we had, you know, it was over 20%, you know, approximate number, looking at just, you know, the numbers. And, you know, usually on the spawning ground, it's, you know, an average is like 8 to 10% of, you know, the fish that you encounter on the spawning grounds are females.
Okay.
And again, the size range, the age, you know, like there were.
Hello?
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. What happened there?
Okay. I'm sorry. I was like, just drew a blank there.
Oh, okay.
I'm getting confused. Like the two, you know, the trophy season is, yeah, is a separate thing. You know, yeah, during the spawning stock survey, I mean,
right,
again, it's totally different.
Right.
It's really sampling the same fish that,
okay,
that are harvested in.
Yeah.
You know, in
so you basically what you were saying is when you're sampling on the spawning grounds, you encountered a higher number of females than normal, and it was like 20% last year.
Correct. Yeah,
okay,
last year.
All
you
right
know, there were 18 different age classes, 18 different, you know, years of fish from, you know, age 2 up to 19 that we encountered.
Really?
I mean, that, you know, that our survey encountered. That's not to say there were older fish out there.
Right.
Whereas during the trophy season itself, you know, the size, or, you know, the age range was like 5-year-old fish to 17-year-old fish. There were 13-year classes, you know, present in the fishery.
So, okay.
Fisheries like two, you know.
Yeah,
like
I'm with you.
Getting
all
confused.
Right.
You know, we're looking at two different things here, but
sure,
really the same population. But,
okay,
you know, two different aspects of it.
So we'll boil this down real quick. It was when you did the spawning surveys on the spawning grounds, you found 18 different age classes of fish from ages 2 to 19.
Last year. Yep.
Last year. On the fishing survey during the trophy season, you found 13 different year classes. So the smaller fish weren't being targeted, and you were catching fish up to into that 17-year-old range, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, what then caused last year's low juvenile survey results?
The survey results were like a whole other issue. That was really because of an environmental issue.
Okay.
You know, people, you know, again, people were concerned that, well, you know, there wasn't any spawn, there were no fish out there, and there were fish out there. There
sure
were, you know, it was one of the better years of you know, abundance of the spawning stock.
Right.
But, you know, again, because of this mild, warm, dry winter that we had,
mm-hmm,
it's like the complete opposite for, like, is what you would think would be best for the population.
Right.
I mean, like, various researchers have documented that, you know, a colder than normal winter and then higher than normal spring river flows, which were documented for the past, you know, the past, or rather, were documented for 2011 when we had that wonderful year class.
Sure.
You know, one of the highest year classes on record.
Okay.
And last year it was like the complete opposite.
The environmental situation caused an issue that the fish did not, the recruitment wasn't as high as it had been before.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
And that was, you know, basically environmental conditions.
Right. And we had that again. You said warm, dry temperature. You want a little bit wet in the spring. Even a little bit coolish.
Cool. Cool.
Yeah. Like this year, which should be a prime spawn survey, you would think, right?
Well, we're keeping our fingers crossed.
Yeah, of course.
This is, you know, there's a fair amount of, or there was a fair amount of snow in Pennsylvania,
yeah,
you know, up into New York State. There was, you know, there's been cold temperatures. The
sure
only thing that we would not want to see right now would be, you know, a very dramatic drop in temperature.
Sure.
That can affect, you know, once spawning has occurred, you know, those larvae are you know, very susceptible to environmental shocks,
right,
like a temperature change or, you know, a higher salinity for some reason because,
right,
of low flow, you know, things like that. And it's a matter of, you know, just being susceptible to temperature. You know, food availability is affected by
temperature.
Temperature and inflow rates, you know,
sure,
the right water conditions. So.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, I don't want to jinx.
No, but keep your fingers crossed, right?
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. We're coming up on a break here real quickly, but what do you guys find in the water temperature is right now?
Right now in the Upper Bay in the Potomac, it's about 50 degrees, you know, and that's like not at the surface, it's down, you know, approximately a meter or so.
Right. Okay.
So that's a good sign.
Okay. Hey, stick with me there, Harry. Harry Hornick, ladies and gentlemen, Maryland Department of Natural Resources, fisheries ecologist specializing in striped bass. We'll be right back after these messages. This is Alan Ellis for Linex Spray-On Bedliners. Catonsville Linex and Bay Linex of Glen Burnie are proud to provide outstanding customer service, just like their number one rated Linex spray-on bedliners with a nationwide lifetime warranty. A Linex spray-on bedliner completely seals out water, meaning no rust. It has a durable non-slip surface and is impervious to fuels and harsh chemicals, deer blood, crab juice, and it protects against impact and abrasion from tree stands and tools and all the other junk you carry in your truck bed. It's easy to clean at your local car wash, too. Catonsville Linex and Bay Linex of Glen Burnie now offer the new Linex Premium that looks better and lasts longer. Catonsville Linux is located at 5617 Baltimore National Pike, inside Beltway Exit 15A. Call 410-455-0800. That's 410-455-0800. Bay Linux of Glen Burnie is located at 400 Arundel Corporation Road, just off Beltway Exit 3A. Call 410-789-0199. That's 410-789-0199. Protect your investment, your pickup truck, like I did with a Linux spray-on bed liner. Nothing is more frustrating than a dead battery. When your truck won't start or your boat or ATV leaves you stranded far from home, that's not good. The solution is Battery Warehouse. Not only does Battery Warehouse provide batteries for your car or truck, you can find marine batteries for cranking or trolling, ATV batteries, tractor batteries, motorcycle batteries, and batteries for all outdoors equipment. Did you know Battery Warehouse has batteries for wild game feeders, dog collars, cell phones, predator calls, and trail cameras? How about your video camera? Or if you tow your boat or trailer, your trailer brake control battery? Any battery you need. With 10 locations in Central Maryland, there's a Battery Warehouse convenient to you. Bel Air, Frederick, Cockeysville, Glen Burnie, Dundalk, Hagerstown, Westminster, Eldersburg, Parkville, and Woodlawn. Visit BatteryWarehouseMaryland.com online for the phone numbers and more information. When you need a hot flash, get to the Battery Warehouse near you.
If you're a working man and your truck breaks down, you only need to know one repair shop, W&W Tire and Auto Service in Finksburg. They built your reputation on getting you in, fixed, and out the door quickly, efficiently, and at a very competitive price. Bridgestone and Firestone tires for pickups, SUVs, and commercial vehicles, large trucks, motorhomes, even diesel engines are no problem. W&W Tire and Auto Service on Route 140, 3233 Baltimore Boulevard in Finksburg. Just look for that big American flag. Call for an appointment, 410-833-8410, W&W.
The following is a paid announcement.
Governor O'Malley wants to enact laws that burden the right of self-defense for the law-abiding citizen. These restrictions will deny rights to those least able to afford them. The governor openly admits he wants to tax a civil right and make it a profit center for Maryland. The governor proposes laws that violate American values. His laws will not target criminals. His laws will only convert the lawful into criminals. The governor's penalties against law-abiding people will cause the loss of jobs, security clearances, and could even stop you from getting a mortgage. The governor's laws will subject active duty service members to prison time if they cannot register their firearms while serving overseas. They will subject young hunters to prison time for possessing common hunting ammunition, and you'll risk prison for not knowing to register a hunting firearm that the state previously approved you to own. Gun control helps no one. This message brought to you by Maryland citizens. Learn more at MarylandShallIssue.org.
This is the Wall Street Journal Report. I'm Marcy Norton. Splashy extended opening weekends are common for blockbuster movies, and they're becoming more common for lower-budget films. When Paramount Pictures' G.I. Joe Retaliation debuted, the first showings were not on a Friday. Some people got to see it as early as Tuesday night. Paramount's original release date of Friday, March 29th, was moved up to Thursday because many students would be out of school on Good Friday. Then it decided theaters could start showing the movie the prior night. And some theaters were allowed to sell tickets to members of their loyalty programs on Tuesday night. Ticket sales from early screenings get rolled into the next day's total, giving a movie an opening day gross that includes more than 24 hours worth of business. The practice is controversial. Critics say box office records with an extra evening of screenings deserve an asterisk. There's also disagreement as to whether early openings actually boost a movie's gross, something people who would go to the movie anyway just go earlier. I'm Marcy Norton with the Wall Street Journal.
There are many debt relief plans and scams out there, so if you find yourself with $10,000 or more in credit card debt and you just want the facts about a legitimate, government-compliant debt relief solution, then call American Credit Card Solutions for a free informational DVD that will tell you about this money-saving option in simple, easy-to-understand terminology. The DVD is free, the shipping is free, and there is absolutely no sales pitch, just the facts sent directly to you in the mail. The free informational DVD can be mailed to you today so you can examine this amazing debt relief option in the comfort of your home with no one pressuring you to make a quick decision. Call 800-448-1155 and ask for your free DVD. This is a first-come, first-serve offer, and DVDs are limited, so call right now for your free debt relief informational DVD. 800-448-1155. That's 800-448-1155.
When will there be indictments in the illegal bugging of Mitch McConnell's offices in Kentucky? On the next Tom Marr Show on Talk Radio 680 WCBN.
Yes! Here comes aim! Hey, we're back with Harry Hornick, fisheries ecologist with Maryland's Department of Natural Resources Fisheries Service, and we were talking about different spawning surveys and surveys that are taken during the trophy season. This is probably one of the most studied fish in the world, isn't it, Harry?
It certainly is on the East Coast. There are other, species of fish that may have more research done in them. But, I mean, I think for the East Coast, I mean, it is probably one of the most researched fish.
Well, we've got
one of the most sought after.
Well, we've got its popularity as far as a sport fish here in Maryland and then also as a commercial fish. People love to eat them because they taste good. Mm-hmm. And, they're highly prized by commercial fishermen and the fishing recreational fishermen as well. So, you guys are you're on the firing line because if there's no fish, it's your fault, and if there's lots of fish, it's your fault. And so, you guys are kind of in the middle of the whole crosshairs there. And so now you've got let's just talk about a couple of the surveys. You got the spawning survey, which is going on now.
Right, the spawning stock.
And the spawning stock.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the survey that you do during the recreational trophy season.
Yes, yeah, and what it is, what we're looking for there, I mean, we're looking at basically effort, fishing effort, the amount of effort spent by fishermen and catch rates for, private anglers and charter boat anglers.
Right.
So we're trying to get, trying to tie in, just, again, how much effort, it's an information we need for,
And we've talked about the online survey and that type of thing. There's plenty of places to reach fishery service in the fishing regulation book that you get with your license on the website, and you can go to the online survey and they can report your information. And we always like to tell people about that because the more people know about it, the more they tend to respond.
And it's very important to us. I mean, a lot of people sometimes they want to help, they want to be involved in the management process, and this is one way, very important, relevant way,
right,
for recreational anglers to help manage the population of striped bass. And actually, for the volunteer angler survey, it actually, if you look on our website, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember all the fish that we are now collecting information for.
But, right.
Summer flounder, striped bass. I mean, there's now is a snakehead survey.
Right.
And I mean, at some point, it's basically because of limitations of staff. We could possibly have surveys for all our fisheries.
Right.
That the general public could. And again, as I mentioned, it's very important and very helpful when people, especially some of these people that spend a lot of time catch and release fishing in the Upper Bay. I mean, they're the MSSA, the CCA people that are involved in. They're helping manage the stock when they provide, their length information, the numbers of fish that they're catching, what the size range is. It's very helpful.
Sure.
Very helpful. So.
And especially with striped bass. But we talked with Marty a couple weeks ago, and we talked about the angler survey and some of the updates that have been going on there. And I don't know if you were privy to those questions that I raised. You have the snakeheads on there.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, why not the other invasive species? Why not the blue cats? Why not the flathead catfish? Break those down. And I know there was some discussion on that. And I actually went on the survey while we were on the air. I'm not going to do it again today. But we looked at it, and, what popped into my mind immediately was, why if we've got a DNR ID, why can't we use that to log into the angler survey rather than, password and all that type of thing. But, I guess those are things that need to be worked out. So, but it is relatively easy to navigate around that survey for those people who like to do that online, and it's very valuable management information to you guys. So,
definitely. Another thing I'd like to point out is that sometimes, or not sometimes, but the federal government is also in the process. They conduct creel surveys. They're out there interviewing fishermen. Sometimes they're confused with us. Sometimes, DNR fisheries people are confused with the feds. And they're really, they're two separate surveys. They're both relevant. They both tie in, you know, the same. I mean, the information isn't counted doubly, but it does dovetail. It does work, you know, work together.
Right. Well, so, since you have such a highly migratory fish, you've got people from, you know, North Carolina, maybe South Carolina a little bit, all the way up, you know, into Virginia, Maryland, and then up the coast, you know, New Jersey, Delaware, and, you know, just keep going up into New England. And those folks all kind of depend on the umbrella organization, Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. You all work together with that to assess, you know, management of striped bass, not just here in Maryland, not just in the Chesapeake Bay, but the entire you know, Atlantic coast.
Yeah, and the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, as you mentioned, the ASMSC, you know, they're the umbrella organization. They're kind of like the clearinghouse for all states' biological data. And what they do is, you know, they're managing striped bass again because it's so highly migratory.
Right.
You know, they manage it as a, you know, one stock. I mean, years ago, people worried about, you know, what went on in Maryland, what went on in, you know, Virginia. But, you know, we manage, you know, Chesapeake Bay fish, you know, regardless of whether, you know, you have a Maryland license or a Virginia license.
Right.
And then, again, ASMSC looks at it on a coastal basis. You know, all these fish, they mingle on the coast. They, you know, they may return to different spawning areas, but, you know, they're migratory. They're in different jurisdictions. And, you know, that's part of the that's been, you know, part of the problem over the years, you know, trying to get everybody straight,
yeah,
and on the same page. But, you know, you got to give the people at ASMSC a lot of credit. That they, you know, they work hard. They, you know, again, we provide, the states provide a lot of information U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the National Fisheries Service people, they're, you know, they're conducting surveys, they're collecting information, you know, they're working with state biologists,
mm-hmm,
to try and you know, manage these fish and all the fish. I mean, all the species, the managed species on the East Coast, you know,
sure,
as best as we can with the information that we have.
Well, the fact that striped bass is iconic, it gets to be a large size. It's pursued by recreational anglers. It's got a tremendous economic value to recreational and commercial fishing. You know, that's the one we're talking about this morning. And, you know, you've got various recreational groups. You mentioned CCA and MSSA. They all have different goals for the fish. And they, you know, now you've got a big stock assessment coming up this summer. Isn't that correct?
Yes. Yeah, it's done every 2 years. And it's good. I mean, and what they do, again, it's biologists from the states, all the states.
Right.
Biologists, scientists up and down the East Coast, you know, along with the feds and ASMSC staff, that, you know, they go over, like, basically with a fine-tooth comb all of the information,
yeah,
that is, you know, is collected and summarized, and, you know, try to get a, you know, a picture of, like, the stock is at a certain time. I
sure.
mean, it's kind of frustrating because it's never, you know, someone could say, well, you know, what's you know, just, you know, pick a number, like, what's the spawning, you know, what's the number of spawning fish, what's the number of fish over a certain age, and their numbers are always changing. I mean, as natural mortality, you know,
well,
fishing, you know,
you can
taken
you,
out, you know.
You know, you can go out and you can take all the surveys and you can put your numbers down, and then the next day you go to the same spot and the numbers are different.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Because fish, and we've said this for 20-some years here, fish swim.
Yeah,
very simple.
Yeah.
Fish swim,
yeah.
And you know, you're not going to get consistent results from day to day, let alone, you know, over a course of any period of time. And now you have all the different, as you mentioned, all the different eyes on these surveys. You've got Fish and Wildlife, you've got ASMFC, you've got the National Marine Fisheries Service. They've got you've got, you know, who else?
Virginia biologists.
Virginia, everybody.
Biologists,
yeah, they're all involved.
Sure.
They're all involved in it. So, you know, everybody's walking a fine line to try and get the best possible numbers.
Yep.
So, all right, let's get out of that because my brain's going numb. Okay. It's trophy bass season. Let's switch gears to that
okay.
a little bit. The limit is one fish over 28 inches,
yes.
correct?
Yep.
All right. So, you catch a lot of fish, 25, 27, but you catch some big fish too.
Yes.
The most common size caught, the most common size of trophy striped bass that we catch out there. Do you have any numbers on that?
Last year, and again, this is we can only say it one
time.
We can look at one year at a time.
Right.
Last year's harvest, the harvest that we did have was dominated by fish between like 31 to 35 inches.
Okay. What year class would that be?
They were from like 8 and 9 year old fish were like the most common. I mean most fish harvested were between 8 and 11 years old. Like an eight year old fish is in that 28 inch range.
Okay.
But again the majority, like over half the fish were like 8 and 9 years old. From like 2003 and 2004 year classes.
Right.
So, but again, remember we've got, during the fishery, there were fish range from 5 to 17.
Right. Exactly.
Our surveys, with our snapshots, we know that striped bass can live up to 31 years.
Really?
I mean, research at the University of Maryland pretty much documented that.
Right.
And so, you hope some of those fish are still swimming around out there, something that old.
Yeah.
What we encountered in our surveys was that, fish range from 28 to 43 inches. Our biologists did not encounter any of those fish that were, how do I want to say this, that were like in the 50-inch range.
Right.
People may have said, hey, I caught this, I caught that. But,
yeah.
We didn't see them, but that's not to say they're not there. We just didn't encounter them. But,
sure.
Well,
that's like the Holy Grail, a 50-inch or 50-pound striped bass. I mean, that's the fish of a lifetime, basically.
Yeah.
And we've got, I think, all of our state records. I'm not sure about the freshwater record, but I know that the three records are all well over 50 pounds. I'm talking about Atlantic Coast and Chesapeake Bay. I was trying to think there was a difference of a surf record, but that's basically the offshore record, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so those fish are all over 60 pounds, and I can't remember what the record is. I know the guy that caught the record fish in Liberty, but I can't call their weight right now. I think it was 53 or 54. 8 pounds, I can't remember, but they get pretty big.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they get pretty big. So we're catching. We're trying to catch 6 big fish on the charter boat, and we got fish coming in. How do we, the male female ratio? I guess is the question I want to ask. What are we catching when we're catching those big fish?
Yeah, when we're catching. Again, when we're out on the research survey, we're looking at like all the fish combined.
Right.
When we're looking at the trophy season, it's very different. We're looking at fish 28 inches and above.
Right.
And last year 75% of the harvest that we sampled were females.
Okay. So it's a 3-to-1 basically, 25% to 75 males to 75% females.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And that was last year again, and that's and that can vary from 30 to 70 to to 31 to 69 and however.
Because of the management strategy, the regulations, they're targeting larger fish.
Yeah.
That's most of those are female.
Sure.
Most of those are female. So actually, that 75%, it may be up to 80 or 85%
sure.
this year.
Okay.
And people are, some people get concerned about that. They say, hey, you're hurting your brood stock. You shouldn't be harvesting those fish. And some people, people do catch and release only, which is admirable.
Right.
But, again, this, the fish is heavily managed.
Yep.
We being the state of Maryland.
Yep.
We're trying to provide our recreational fishermen with the opportunity. We only get a small amount of time to get these fish.
Sure.
Our fishery is actually, believe it or not, is relatively conservative.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
All right. Because we got a little break coming up here that we've got to take. And it's time for me to tell the folks about Clyde Sport Shop. If you want to catch one of those big trophy stripers, we recommend that you go to Clyde Sport Shop and check out their entire line of rockfish gear. They've got the trolling rods and reels. They've got the line. They've got the pen reels. They've got the Shakespeare rod and reel combos. They've got the umbrella rigs and the big bucktails and the trolling lures and the spoons and everything you need to catch your trophy striped bass. Now, you know, if you don't concentrate on striped bass, you want to go catch some crappies or trout or perch or something like that, they've got the live bait and the tackle for that, too. Clyde Sports Shop, 2307 Hammonds Ferry Road in Lansdowne, just off Beltway Exit 9. Give them a call at 410-242-6108. Call the fishing hotline at 410-247-FISH. That's 247-3474. We'll be right back after these messages.
The following is a paid announcement.
Governor O'Malley wants to enact laws that burden the right of self-defense for the law-abiding citizen. These restrictions will deny rights to those least able to afford them. The governor openly admits he wants to tax a civil right and make it a profit center for Maryland. The governor proposes laws that violate American values. His laws will not target criminals. His laws will only convert the lawful into criminals. The governor's penalties against law-abiding people will cause the loss of jobs, security clearances, and could even stop you from getting a mortgage. The governor's laws will subject active duty service members to prison time if they cannot register their firearms while serving overseas. They will subject young hunters to prison time for possessing common hunting ammunition. And you'll risk prison for not knowing to register a hunting firearm that the state previously approved you to own. Gun control helps no one. This message brought to you by Maryland citizens. Learn more at MarylandShallIssue.org.
This is Alan Ellis for Linex Spray-On Bedliners. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie and Catonsville Linex are proud to provide outstanding customer service just like their number one rated Linex Spray-On Bedliners with a nationwide lifetime warranty. A Linex Spray-On Bedliner completely seals out water, meaning no rust. It has a durable non-slip surface and is impervious to fuels and harsh chemicals, deer blood, crab juice, and it protects against impact and abrasion from tree stands, tools, and all the other junk you carry in your truck bed. It's easy to clean at the local car wash. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie and Catonsville Linex now offer the new Linex Premium that looks better and lasts longer. Bay Linex of Glen Burnie, located at 400 Arundel Corporation Road, just off Beltway Exit 3A. Call 410-789-0199. That's 410-789-0199. And Catonsville Linex is located at 5617 Baltimore National Pike, inside Beltway Exit 15A. Call 410-455-0800. That's 410-455-0800. Protect your investment, your pickup truck like I did, with a Linex Spray-On Bedliner.
If you enjoy decoy collecting and great wildlife art, waterfowl hunting, or a scenic walk along the bay, it's time for the 32nd Annual Decoy and Wildlife Art Festival at the Harbor de Grace Decoy Museum. This year's event is Friday evening, May 3rd, Saturday, May 4th, and Sunday, May 5th. Admission is free. Over 120 exhibitors and artists display paintings and prints, sculptures and carvings, photography and sportsman's collectibles. There's great food, retriever dog demonstrations, and much more. The annual live auction is 5:30 p.m. on Saturday at the Activity Center. Free shuttle buses run between the museum, the middle school, and the activity center. Harbor de Grace commemorates the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812 the same weekend. Celebrate the bicentennial by attending the Decoy and Wildlife Art Festival. Learn about the great hunting traditions of the Chesapeake at the Decoy Museum on May 3rd, 4th, and 5th with free admission to this family-friendly event. For more information, visit decoymuseum.com or call 410-939-3739. See you at the Decoy Festival.
W&W Tire and Auto Service in Finksburg has taken care of my trucks for over 25 years. Anything from a simple oil change to extensive engine work, brakes, tune-ups, everything. Their motto is, we do it. Bridgestone and Firestone tires for pickups, SUVs, and commercial vehicles. Large trucks, motorhomes, even diesel engines are no problem. W&W Tire and Auto Service on Route 140, 3233 Baltimore Boulevard in Finksburg. Look for the big American flag. Call for an appointment, 410-833-8440. 410 W&W Tire and Auto.
For great fishing tackle, crabbing supplies, and up-to-date fishing and crabbing information, I recommend Fishbones Bait and Tackle in Pasadena. To get there, take Route 100 to the end. Hop on Mountain Road towards Gibson Island. Go 2.5 miles to 4729 Mountain Road. Fishbones has all you need for any type of fishing, crabbing, and the best fishing report in the Mid-Bay. Fishbones also carries the best stainless steel crab steamers you'll ever find. Call 410-360-0573. That's 410-360-0573 for Fishbones Bait and Tackle in Pasadena.
Okay, we're back with Harry Hornick, who's a fisheries ecologist with the... When did you stop being fisheries biologist and start being fisheries ecologist?
Actually, when I was in graduate school.
Yeah.
That was my research was fisheries ecology.
And oh, okay.
You know what? You know, somebody said, "Well, you're not a biologist; you're an ecologist." And
there it
really
stuck. There it is.
A difference.
All right.
We have a lot of good biologists in the department. We've got a few ecologists. You know, Alexi Sheriff is definitely a person that's in that category.
Sure.
Marty Gary. You know.
Yep.
But I mean, we're all biologists. We're all trying to collect the most relevant information and analyze it the best.
Absolutely.
That we can.
All right. Well, where we left the last hour when I kind of rushed you through that, your explanation there, which I apologize for, was that we had talked about the ratio, male-female ratio last year of 25% male and 25% female, and you were just starting to get into
75%. Yeah, 75%.
75% female, excuse me, 25-75, 3-1, basically. And you were talking about people being concerned that the fishery stock was being depleted because you're taking all the big spawning females out of the population. And you were addressing that right before the break. My take on this is that the Virginia fishery at the Bay Bridge tunnels and the North Carolina fishery probably does more damage than we do here in Maryland, but that's for the biologists to work out. On a personal note, and nothing against your management or anything else, but I don't particularly care for the catch and release season on the spawning reaches in the flats. That's personal thing that I've never been for, is catching those big fish pre-spawning females on the flats before they spawn. And we had a discussion about this the other day with people from CCA and some other folks, and basically they said, well, the science is there, the fish are returned without being hurt, and was quite frankly stated that nobody really knows if those fish actually participate in the spawn after they've been, caught and stressed and taken out of the water and photographed and released. So my feeling on that is, I'm not going to fish it, but if that's what you want to do, you go right ahead. So I'm getting into some personal stuff there.
That's fine.
Hey,
it's your show.
Hey, we're talking about stripers. I'm just, you might tell me I'm full of mud, but that's okay.
Nope.
That's okay. I'll just continue to express my opinion on that.
I'd say that's an admirable view. It's very pro resource, and I'm fine with that.
Sure. Well, you're saying you're getting some. Occasionally, you're getting a little pushback from folks on the female stock being taken out. So I launched into my diatribe there. What do you say?
Well, again, we are looking at we are harvesting a very relevant component of the population. But as you mentioned, and people do admit this, that what we harvest, the facts are there that what we harvest in Chesapeake Bay during the springtime compared to what is harvested up and down. Again, these fish, they're in the bay for a couple of months, 2 to 3 months. They spawn, they leave the bay, and they're not being caught by us, but they are being caught by everybody else and their brother,
right,
up and down the East Coast, the New England states. They have a very extensive, summer fall fishery.
Sure they do.
And
yeah.
Just, again, they're getting
New Jersey.
Yes,
you know.
Exactly. All New York. They're harvested, and again, they're monitored. Their biologists are working up there.
Sure.
To monitor and keep track, monitor the harvest, look at the same information that we talked about this morning, the age structure, the sex ratios, the timing, all that information. So, again, they're trying to do their part in maintaining, the research, or the level of research to understand what's going on with the population.
And that's why people have to understand that, yes, the department is charged with setting the creel limits and the size limits. And you don't do this just arbitrarily. You do this based on science.
Yes.
And
yes.
You have to do it based on science. Now, down the road, what may happen? Could the structure of the season change? Could the season be a trophy season, be earlier, later, larger fish? We had a slot limit here a couple years ago. People went insane.
Yeah.
Because of that, but it was the best thing to do for the resource. And that's always been my philosophy. Let's do what's best for the resource.
Yeah, when the fishery first opened in 91, the first year, the minimum size was 36 inches.
Right, I remember that.
Some people applauded that, and other people just were outraged.
And it broke my heart to have a 34-inch striped bass that I caught go back in the water. But
and people told us that. they did. It was frustrating because again, we don't impose a minimum length size
right
to be mean to somebody.
No.
People called me, you know, my 12-year-old son was crying. He had to let this, you know, like you said, a 35-inch fish.
Yeah, right.
Good. It's not worth the ticket.
That's right.
But, you know, if you look over time, I mean, it basically started dropping 36-inch, 32-inch, you know, went to 28 for a few years. Then it went up a little bit. In 2007, we had the slot limit.
Yeah.
And now we're back at 28 inches.
Yeah.
And basically what we have seen is, you know, a kind of a transition of the stock that, you know, we've protected, you know, the population, you know, had, over that period of time grew, you know, the age structure changed, you know, it expanded for those larger fish.
Sure.
You know, we're you know, and it may change again. I mean,
you've had some pretty tremendous year classes that are all grown up now.
Yes.
And there's a ton of those fish out there. But let's look at last year's low juvenile survey index. You know, that's not going to have anything to do with our fishery this year.
No. In fact, I mean, those fish like really don't start showing up in the spawning stock until like age five.
Right.
I mean, that's when they really first start to show up.
Right.
So, you know, and again, you know, we talk about, you know, the important year classes being like, you know, 8 and 9 year old fish. Those,
sure.
You know, those are the ones that, you know, that's like, those are the, you know, the most frequent, like every year, you know, 8 and 9 year old fish,
right.
You know, are like a
they're dominant. They're the peak spawning age. That's the one.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that are prime time in their lives. And you get smaller than that, and they're not as productive. You get larger than that, and they're not as productive.
Yeah. So. Now, you know, the 2011 year class, which was, you know, which is a record year. You know, they'll start entering the fishery not till 2016.
Right.
And this. I hate to say poor year class. I mean, but it was a poor year class, extremely low. You know, what once survived would not have. You know, they won't be entering the fishery until 2017.
Right.
So you may see some changes again because of all the information that's collected and you know people say, well, it's hard to look at just, you know, it's snapshots, but when you put all the snapshots together, then
sure.
You get your long term, your long range. Pattern.
Exactly. So, you know, we may, in 4 years from now, we may have an entirely different season structure.
I don't think it would be entirely different, but there may be modifications.
Well, okay. A week earlier, a week later, a smaller fish, a larger, whatever. There's going to be that because this fishery, this recreational fishery, is very important to us and, you know, economically and every other way, like I just said. So, all right.
Yeah.
We've got a few minutes remaining. I'm going trophy fishing the first week of the season. Where's my best place to catch a big old rockfish?
I know that
a big old fat giant mama rockfish that I'm going to catch and kill and eat
and take pictures of.
Hopefully. And take pictures of.
Take lots of pictures.
Yeah. Where am I going?
You know, Bloody Point is an area that you know in the bay that you know we see and, you know, a lot of people talk about. A lot of people you know call us. You know, they tell us where they're catching fish. You know, there's a couple of areas in the lower bay that I'm convinced of. I mean, I live in southern Maryland. I've talked to a lot of fishermen down here, and you know, areas like the winter gooses, summer gooses, the Chinese muds. I think there's something there, and I mean, and every fisherman has his favorite spot, or
sure.
You know, he has an area where he's got it figured out. He knows what the bottom is like
right.
There. You know, he understands the currents and the tides, but there's something about those areas that I you know again the physics of the bay, you know,
sure.
the water coming in, the tidal influence coming in, you know, the water coming down the bay. I mean, I think there's those areas of the bay, and the same thing with Bloody Point area.
Yeah.
You know, they're areas where I think food concentrates, and you've got, you know, large fish. You know, they've spawned, they're coming down the bay, or you know they're still moving around the bay. That's where people, I think, have had good luck over the years.
Sure, exactly. Well, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you got a consistent area there. You've got, you know, the fish are going to follow the bait for the most part. And you find a bait, you're going to find the fish. For, you know, that's pretty much the basics of fishing, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, just, and again, those folks that, you know, the professionals that are out there and just the, you know, the people that, you know, they may or may not consider themselves experts. Too many of them probably do consider themselves experts.
Right.
You know, some of the people, you know, they've got to figure it out.
Sure.
I mean, some of the charter boat captains down here, I mean, they, I think they could find fish in the dark.
Well, sure they could, absolutely. Yeah. But your main, while we're talking about that, what is the main food resource this time of year for those big trophy fish? Is it the menhaden?
Well, they're menhaden. They'll eat small herring, American shad. I mean, rockfish will eat just about anything that will fit in their mouth.
Right.
And definitely, I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure what the, I know there's some menhaden out there. There's a lot of gizzard shad out there.
Sure.
They're probably not eating the blue catfish, which is a shame.
Probably not, but, the blue catfish are eating them. So
vice versa.
Yeah.
But there is, and that's one of the things in our spring spawning stock survey, we encounter these other species, too. We're seeing, some menhaden out there, a lot of gizzard shad out there. So, that's probably what they're eating. They're eating small shad, again, depending on the size of the rockfish.
Right.
So...
All right. Now I'm going to ask you the clinker here. I'm going to ask you the uh-oh question. What effect do striped bass have on blue crab populations?
We've actually looked at that over the years and, looked at gut contents, examined stomachs. And believe it or not, our surveys show that, they do eat, soft crabs. They do love soft crabs.
Well, sure they do.
And they love eels, but... they don't eat them all the time. I mean, it is a matter, again, they're opportunistic feeders. A lot of people were, some people were believing, oh, we need to lift the limits on striped bass because they're eating all the crabs.
Right.
No, it was a different issue. And when we cut back on crab harvest, look what has happened with blue crabs over the past, 3-4 years.
Right.
It's very different. And they certainly do eat soft crabs. They like them. But, again, striped bass are very opportunistic, and they just,
Well, they'll eat grass shrimp, too.
Yes.
You know?
They'll eat. I think I caught one once that had a mouse in its stomach.
A mouse. Yeah, well, let's see.
On the Patuxent River, and that poor mouse thought he was going to take whatever reason, was crossing a creek, and, a striped bass ate him.
Yeah, he was probably being chased by a fox.
The food chain issue there. But
it wasn't his day no matter what happened.
He was screwed. His number came up. He thought he was swimming. He was all right. Didn't work out.
Man, I got out of the clutches of that black rat snake, and here I am out. I'm just
paddling
loving life here in this creek.
Boom. Where did that come from?
That's pretty funny.
They can have a minor impact.
Yeah.
For the most part, no, they did not. They're not responsible for any kind of
yep.
Abundance changes for crabs.
All right. We've got just a couple minutes left here. We've got about a minute left. Let me ask you just a snapshot, or just give me the overall status of the striped bass stock in Maryland.
Well,
on a scale of 1 to 10.
One to ten?
Yeah.
I'd say a 7 to an 8.
Okay.
I mean, people would say, well, why isn't it a 10? Or people would say, well, I think it's a 5.
And, right.
I think,
Well, you're the guy.
Well, there's a bunch of guys. There's a bunch of people working really hard on it. And, I think we're all in agreement that, the striped bass population, it's not overfished.
Right.
Overfishing is not occurring.
Good.
Those are like that's the official, the official wording from, through ASMSC. But I stand behind them. We do a lot of research. The population is very heavily managed.
Yep.
It's quite different than it was, 25 years ago.
Harry Hornick.
Definitely.
Fisheries ecologist, Maryland Department of Natural Resources. Thanks for joining us this morning. And we're going to go out telling folks about the Maryland Fishing Challenge. So we appreciate you being here, and we'll
Thank
catch
you,
up with you later in the season. Thanks.
Right. And good luck to all those fishermen out there.
There you go. Thanks, right. Harry.
Thank you, Alan.
Take care. Bye-bye. Hey, it's time for the Maryland Fishing Challenge. You could win great prizes like a grand prize boat, motor, and trailer rig from Bass Pro Shop, or thousands in tackle from Bill's Outdoor Center, and prizes from sponsors like the World Fishing Network and Under Armour. From now through Labor Day, all you have to do is go fishing. If you're lucky enough to catch a Maryland citation-sized fish or crab and certify your catch, you're in. It's that easy. There are more than 60 species of fish in freshwater, tidal rivers, the Chesapeake Bay, and on the Atlantic coast to qualify. Stop by your local fishing citation center, check the fishing rule book, or visit www.dnr.maryland.gov for all the details in the 2013